This is Modern Fable. This is the fourth test cast that I've done. I wanted to do an interview kind of format, so my dad is here with me, and I actually don't know what stories he's going to tell, so it should be pretty interesting.
Well, I'm sitting here today across from Matthew talking about, well, stories.
Yeah.
It's kind of ironic. You know, sitting here, he's got his laptop out, he's got the microphone on in front of me. Going back to his upbringing.
This is just going to open that can of worms right there.
Yeah, open that can of worms. I'm very proud of my son as he's sitting here with all his techno gadgets recording me at the moment. Just thinking through his fascination for life.
Yeah.
His zeal to understand that which isn't understood yet. His interest in the interplay between humanity, uses of technology, and why people do what they do. Of course, I can't explain all that to him, certainly not in the time it would take for this podcast, but it brings me back to an ideal.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good place to start. It would be a good question to ask at some point, but I think I can't answer it for myself either. So it'd be a bit difficult. I don't want to spend too much time on that, at least when I'm doing my studies in the future, because I feel like that's like its own study in itself. But yeah.
Matthew was kind of unique. I think he had his own computer from the time he was about 3 years of age. Okay.
Yeah.
I was big on technology. I'm actually a former technology educator.
Yeah. That helped.
Yeah, it did help. He seemed enthralled with the computer.
I remember that game. I remember playing that. I remember you trying to make typing into a game, and that was the one game I actually wouldn't play. So,
Putt-putt had absolutely no purpose to it whatsoever.
Enjoyment is also good, too. But yeah, I get your point. Yeah, there was
it was a sugar coated digital digital suite, so to speak,
and with a car and all that.
With a car and really not much of a story to it. As much as we were very much a digital home,
yeah.
Okay, Matthew and his sister were certainly not denied any of the digital goodies that might have existed at the time.
Yeah. I mean, I remember growing up and like talking to my teachers, and they would like be like, "I don't really know what's going on with the computer," and I'm like, "I'll step back. I got this. Don't worry about it." But like, I didn't think that was weird until a little bit later when I was like, I didn't realize that people just didn't have that kind of connection with technology. But
well, no, most people didn't have their own computer starting at the age of three.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm drawn to a statement that John Lasseter, the co-founder of Pixar, made. And it really is that without a good story,
right,
all the technology in the world can't make it better. And
right,
we look at, you know, what Pixar has brought to the world over the years. Matthew and his sister grew up in what we'll call an interesting contrast. As much as we like the digital realm, everything that was available to them, I believe that there are aspects of the imagination to be developed where, you know, technology was good, but it wasn't the be-all and end-all of the work. And so I would read to them constantly.
I remember that. Yeah, when going to bed, I remember, I think it was, I remember vividly The Hobbit and the
Hobbit. Yeah, The Hobbit, all of the Chronicles of Narnia, The Boxcar Children, back and forth between Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, not trying to be, you know, have a gender buy on this whole thing.
I think you were the only one who really wanted the gender buy. I think I remember my sister and I both like vying for ours to be next. It must have been difficult, but like, I remember, like, oh, it's the Hardy Boys. You finished the book. And then you're like, well, we got to go over to Nancy Drew. And Jessica's like, yes. And I'm like, oh, come on. There's a cliffhanger at the end of the Hardy Boys that I want to get to. And it's like, oh, you got to wait your turn.
So back and forth, alternating between Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys.
I forgot about the Hardy Boys. I remember having the blue books on the bookshelf for the Hardy Boys. That was fun.
What really kind of brought it home was... We'd have movies on, and I thought that was, like, really great. Doing some work. The kids would be occupied for a little while. And I discovered, well, not discovered, of course, having been around since I was a kid, that Mary Poppins was over 2 hours. So I figured, great. Kids love repetition. really love repetition. And I'd get a break. I'd get some work in. They would be happily occupied watching Mary Poppins.
Yeah, I think Mary Poppins, then Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was another one of our
favorites.
Chitty
Chitty Bang Bang.
And Sound of Music was a huge one for us.
Sound of Music, you watched at least a few times. And then, of course, there was Jurassic Park.
Yeah, that was the best movie ever.
I realized over time it would have been easier for me to just to buy the darn movie than what it was to rent it as often as they watched it.
I think my sister and I asked him to rent it every time we went to the movie store. And there was a movie store down the street from us, so we went pretty frequently to kind of watch a movie. And I just remember always wanting to watch it over again, because it's just a great movie. I actually watched it in theaters they brought it back in theaters, and that was really great to see it for the first time in theaters, because I wasn't old enough when it came out.
So. Right. The issue I realized with Mary Poppins, yeah, it's like great over 2 hours, but the songs over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
There was very little value to the movie after you've watched it a couple of times. But having the kids recite the songs to the movie was a little bit much after viewing it. I figured, hey, there's a better solution to this.
The Spoonful of Sugar.
Supercalifragilistic. All of that after a while. Well,
I mean, you should be happy that we didn't grow up in like the frozen current Disney era, because those songs are getting stuck in your head like forever.
Right.
But I do remember like us just trying to sing our hearts out to those songs. So.
Yes, sing the songs over and over and over again. And, you know, I think there's more to life. Not saying it's a bad movie. It was skillfully done in its era. Dick Van Dyke, Julie Andrews, just very entertaining. But I wanted more for the kids. And so I began reading to them and reading to them and reading to them. The number of books... which I can't even count the number of books at this point. Yeah. Many of the great classics from, Treasure Island, again, the entire Chronicles of Narnia.
Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, yeah,
absolutely. Yes, we did.
Yeah, I remember that actually kind of vividly now. Because I remember, I think, getting to the part with the robbers in the cave, and then also where Tom Sawyer tricks a bunch of his friends to do painting for him. So
right, you know, you get to those stories. I also had to skillfully change the pejoratives, the racial pejoratives on the fly.
I guess it would be kind of surprising when you open up the book and you're like, oh, right, this is a very different era.
A much different era. Was able to change some of the racial references, and it was appropriate for the age of kids to still enjoy the story.
Right.
So the fact that I abridged Mark Twain's work, well, I'm guilty of that. But
I think we're going to forgive you on that one. It was a good abridge, because I can imagine my sister and I were pretty young at the time. So if we had learned those words, we would have definitely used them. We had a very restrictive kind of vocabulary at that point, so we would try to use whatever we could. And so it was better to just kind of ignore those words. It's not like a censorship thing. It's more of like, you know, they probably shouldn't go around in public saying these things.
Yeah, a little bit of discretion was appropriate with the words. But in any case, countless number of books. And on the occasions that I ran out of books, I'd make up my own stories. Okay.
Yeah.
That spawned some... a fictional town that I created called Twilight Junction.
Right. Yeah, my sister and I were very fond of that one.
Twilight Junction, a little bit of Yesterday, a little bit of today and a glimpse of tomorrow. It was basically the stories about an era gone by in today's world, recapturing the innocence of the innocence that perhaps our society can take from us a little bit too.
Yeah, quickly. It was about a group of kids, right? And who
couple of kids, yes.
I remember part of the story because it was a mystery story, because we really enjoyed those when we were there was an aspect of mystery in that story, because my sister and I really enjoyed those stories when we were growing up, so I think you were kind of hurled into that category. But it was, I remember growing up and it was really, they were great. So
right, and actually in the years since, I've thought of continuing with the stories, but really haven't had the time. Strange little twists, ironic twists in the story, just about the kids, you know, two kids growing up in Twilight Junction in the dawn of the era of technology.
Right.
And so it was fun. But what I learned, or at least was reinforced in all of that reading, is what John Lasseter had to say, which is that without the story, all the technology in the world doesn't make a difference. And I do believe that building the imagination, in which a child needs to, you know, kind of develop their own mental picture,
right,
develop their own way of hearing, interpreting, and right, understanding the stories is very important.
Right.
Because I think today with Matthew's inquisitiveness, his hard work, his fascination with the field of psychology, is in part an outcome of being able to dream as he desired to dream, to imagine, to develop his imagination. Now, that doesn't say that technology doesn't have an important role in today's world, as I'm looking at the gear Matthew has in front of him.
Yeah.
And the gear that he uses, or the tools that he uses in modern psychology. But I think even as new technologies are adapted, new technologies are revealed, and we continue as a society or a civilization to use technology tools as assistive living, learning, and adapting tools, there is a place for the human imagination. There is a book I read a few years ago called What Technology Wants by Kevin Kelly.
I actually got recommended that book recently. I need to read it.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Who recommended it to you?
I was actually, ironically, listening to a couple podcasts. It's been over the span of like three different podcasts from three different people that are like, oh, this book about what technology wants. And I'm like, okay, I think I even have it written down on my phone.
Do you really?
Really?
It's a wonderful read. It's a wonderful read. And Kevin Kelly goes back through history and looking at the different types of technologies, the different eras or epochs of human history, and the role that technology plays in the development of civilization. In a way, technology is an inorganic.
I think, actually, well, it is and it isn't. It has its own almost life to it. Where it
has
grows.
its own life to it. That technology itself,
right,
will seek its own
kind of creation, kind of perseverance, and kind of like populate. Like, I don't think there are times when people have technology, but when a technology actually comes out, it's like it propagates. And it, like, if you think about electricity, how quickly we got electricity, or even just modern plumbing. Like, it was so, once you find something. And I think one of the things we talk about on a regular basis is the iPhone, because it's coming up on the 10th year anniversary. Mm-hmm. And that kind of makes me think about the fact that 10 years ago, smartphones, that concept was very kind of almost science fiction, where it's like you have those types of technologies, and it's like, but now, actually when I was visiting your work, there was a kid who was, I'm sure he was like 8, and he had an iPhone in his hand, and I'm like, that's just crazy. Like, I got my first iPhone when I was around 15, 16, and that was because I was an early adopter.
Oh, you're feeling old all of a sudden.
Well, I'm not feeling old. I just, it's not a feeling old. It's more of a, this is a weird kind of era in itself, because it's, I got my first cell phone at 13 and it was for emergencies only. And it was a basic flip phone. And I remember the coolest thing I can learn about that phone is that my friend taught me how to open it in a cool way with just my thumb. Like that was the sly way to show off your phone. But
well, if the kid's 8 years old, then the iPhone is older than him.
Yeah. Yes. The invention of the iPhone. But the whole thing is that it kind of has its own life to the phone. Like, or the technology has its own kind of presence and, like, wanting to grow and interact.
Well, one of the points that, that stayed with me there from reading the book was... Kevin Kelly stated that the Amish, for example, are not anti-technology.
Right.
What they are, in general, is a is focused on the community.
Right.
And so they will actually test technologies
right.
to see if they help community life or move people away from community
right.
life. So it's why you might see solar panels, for example, in an Amish barn, but the family still travels by horse and buggy.
Yeah, I think that was when I think, because you had told me that once, and I think at that time I actually had to look that up, because it was just, it was kind of such a far-fetched idea of like, oh, I guess they could technically have solar panels and that would be really great for the Amish, but they do, like, they, or yeah, that's just weird. But it's good. I mean, it's good philosophy.
It is a good philosophy, and that could, you know, lead to strange kind of, well, strange appearing things like, again, solar panels on a barn, on an Amish barn, but the family traveling by horse and buggy as the mode of human transportation. So there is always the human factor. In our society, that as much as our society seems to be propelling itself forward at an ever-accelerating pace, or at least civilization, I should say, there is the human element, whether
right.
it's been with children, working with them to develop their imagination, despite all of the all the mediums that can engage the senses. Among the most important things that develop in a child is their ability to develop their imagination.
Yeah, there's a actually with having referenced John Lasseter earlier. I think him, Hayao Miyazaki, and Tsao. I'm gonna botch this name, but it's the other person from Studio Ghibli. All three of them have this kind of philosophy that it's not that they couldn't do a movie in live action. It's more of a fact that they want to do a movie that you can only do in animation, which is part of the reason why Pixar is so kind of spectacular, is because it's not that they want to tell a great story, but it's also, it's a story they can only tell in that medium. Like if they could film it, then why do it in animation? Animation is such high budget, but it's supposed to kind of expand kind of your mental picture. And I remember when Toy Story came out, and you, I think you're the one who we saw it with, because you were very big on Pixar even back then, and it was the most wild thing because of the animation. And I watch it now recently, and it looks kind of strange, but it was I think at the time where it was like this technology that we were using that that kind of, it kind of blew my mind, and like it made you think about all the different ways, and like think about, first thing, if your toys are alive, because that would be weird. But also think about, like,
yeah, it would be weird if your toys were alive. Absolutely weird. That would be, well, I don't know. Give it 10, 20,
30 years,
25
yeah.
years, whatever the case may be, and just in terms of animation, not that they'd
right,
be
right.
alive, but they may be far more animated than what they are
right.
today. Studio Ghibli, they produced, well, the classics such as Spirited
yeah.
Away, which I think is a marvelous movie.
Right.
Was it Howl's Moving Castle?
Right.
Is another movie that is enthralling.
Right.
The animation isn't necessarily complex.
No, it's not.
But it tells a very, very good story.
Right.
You can sit there. You can be engrossed in the movie. In a way, you know, it can be a little bit of a vacation from the stresses of everyday life, even as an adult, just to really enjoy this movie and the story that it tells. You're right. It couldn't be, well, I don't know how you would do it in live action.
Right.
But I think animation lends itself to that form of storytelling.
Right. All right. We're going to take a break right here and then get back to what we were doing. So thanks for listening. Hey, we're back.
So there's always a contrast to the story, being a champion of technology and education, where the two styles or approaches to, well, I don't call them two styles, let's say development of the imagination,
right?
Kind of an old-fashioned way, through kids making a mental picture for themselves. Drawing in their mind, so to speak, or painting in their mind, I think brings about a more vivid imagination. But there is definitely a place for technology in education, in the lives of children and in the lives of adults. One of the stories that I thought was really kind of funny is that Matthew had just gotten, a laptop.
Right.
Soon after getting a laptop, and so he asked me if I'd play him a chess.
Sounds like something I would do.
I would know all the rules. Okay, gee, well, how long is this going to take? How much patience will it require? Bring them through the basics of chess. Okay,
right. Don't start with checkers. Go straight to chess. Right?
Went straight to chess. Well, I kind of marveled at how much he had picked up because he had been playing against the computer.
Right.
Okay. And his skills were pretty formidable in a very short period of time. I was impressed. So you see the benefit of critical thinking with technology as an assistive learning tool.
Right. Okay. Well, I on the note of chess, I remember we actually got a chess set, and we got the King Arthur one later, which was really great. But I didn't know that was where that started.
Well, you had learned chess. You had you had learned chess from playing the computer.
Right.
Okay. Which I thought was a marvelous use of the device. Again, the device itself can't really teach.
Right.
But in the hands of an eager student, technology can be a very productive learning tool.
No, okay. I remember, because at least when I was playing chess against the computer, I would learn how to copy it a little bit. Because I'd always lose. And I didn't really understand why I would lose. And that was like, oh my God, checkmate. I remember learning how to copy it in some way. I still enjoy chess. I don't play it as much as I would like, but using the computer as a gateway almost to learning.
Right. When I was in school, this was back a number of years ago, of course.
Yeah, of course.
You'd have a library at the school.
Right.
Okay. The information could be new. The information could be old. But all of the information was vetted, in this case, by a librarian who was a little bit ill-tempered towards us students. But she was dedicated to making sure the information available to the students had been vetted.
Right.
In today's world, it's a vastly different environment.
Right.
There's a world of resources at your fingertips.
Right.
But it's up to the student or the student of life to vet the information for themselves. What's good information? What's bad information? How do you take information, this seemingly infinite amount of data and information, determine what's good information, what's not so good information, what's reliable information, what's not reliable information, then distill it and present it in a manner which communicates the point that you're attempting to make. Whereas in my era, it was more of memorization and regurgitation. There wasn't, you know, we weren't living the digital age we're living in today. And so we were essentially our own little bits or reservoir of information that we would take from place to place. And so today we don't need to memorize as much as we might have in the past. That isn't going to be our learning style, simply because at one's fingertips, you know, really there's a supercomputer in your pocket today.
Right.
A supercomputer, you know, compared to the standards or really the technologies that were available on a mass level going back even 10 years ago.
Well, the thing I think of, I think I heard an anecdote about this recently, is that they sent people to the moon and back, all the Apollo missions. The computer that was on board on those missions is actually less powerful than the smartphone in your pocket.
Having lived through the lunar landing days, and of course, this was an absolute mind blower. Watching, you know, a little bit of a delay, kind of the grainy black and white photos coming back to us from the moon. The pocket computer was pocket calculator was apparently a byproduct of the lunar expedition.
Right.
And when they first came out, they were priced at something seemingly obscene, like over $100. Now put $100 into 1970s, early 1970s terms, that was an awful lot of money for a pocket computer. Pocket calculator. One of the drawbacks of that was that you never saw a slide rule.
Right. No, I didn't. People point to mostly is the fact that, like, I know a very limited number of phone numbers. And it's mostly numbers I had to memorize because those are like my emergency numbers. So I know your number, I know my sister's number, I know my mom's number, I know the house number, I know like those numbers. But after a certain point when I got my cell phone, just it kind of dropped off of actually knowing them. And I'm happy he hasn't changed his cell phone in a number of years, because I don't think I would make an effort, but I don't think I would actually know his new number all that well. And it's kind of strange, because I think I'm in this kind of weird, again, like twilight, where it's just I have like a generation before computers and technology really like went crazy, and where it's in everything, you know.
Yeah, it isn't everything. Not that I ever used a slide rule. That was kind of like for the science brainiacs.
Yeah,
I wasn't quite at that.
Now we need to, like, I'm going to buy a slide rule, and you're going to have to show me how to use it, because of this point. But yeah.
Yeah, so we do see, you know, some of the trade-offs, but technology itself brings so many benefits. Okay, we are an interconnected world. So it brings us now to a point where, you know, our next door neighbor, so to speak, could be around the world.
Right.
Okay. Their physical presence isn't necessary in order to have an engaging relationship with the person. Okay.
Yeah.
Not somebody you're going to be sitting there talking to over the picket fence, so to speak.
Right.
But that relationship may be as real to you as someone who does live next door.
Right.
And this is really looking at how we choose to communicate. just about anywhere. It's always kind of funny watching people as they're kind of walking across the street texting. Right. You think there'd be a good time for texting and a bad time for texting, and that, you know, walking, you know, in the middle of heavy traffic to be walking across the street totally unaware of what's going on around right. you while you text, maybe not be the smartest thing in the world.
No, what the habit I see mostly right now is the fact people who are surrounded by other people, and I've done this and I feel bad about it after thinking about it in retrospect, but I've people who are sitting with other people around them, like they're in a group together with either their friends, their family, or what have you, and they are on their phone, and it's like sometimes the physical presence of them being there is not enough to deter them from actually going to their phone. And it's like you're saying, like, it's like texting and walking. It's like, well, you should be where you are. It doesn't make any sense for you to be talking with someone else when you have people kind of right there. Which I think it makes us a little bit choosier about, like, oh, I really want to talk to this particular person because I can, versus like, I'm kind of stuck with whoever's around me and you kind of make do, you know?
Well, so it's always kind of interesting to watch people go racing for a light,
mm-hmm.
you know, pedestrian go racing up there. Then as soon as the light turns, they seem to walk at a snail's pace while they're texting.
Yeah.
Okay. Or talking, or just meandering across the street
right.
as if time has no consequence.
Right.
So I guess in a way we're living in a world where time has lost some of its meaning, or some of its immediate impact.
Right.
Not to say there shouldn't be the timeless state. One of the things I've advocated, I've not so much advocated for, but I think is still important, is the continued summer vacation for
right.
children.
Okay. Yeah, I know. Yeah, that I'm an advocate for that as well. That's great.
You know, a lot of people think this is a throwback to more agrarian times when the kids were needed out in the field, during the summer. The school year itself was, you know, perhaps timed around around the crops. You know, for example, you know, we're out of school during the summer. You're kind of in school during the winter.
Right.
You know, in agrarian nation, there wasn't a heck of a lot to do around the farm or around the homestead, wherever you want to call it, during
right.
the winter months.
Right.
Okay, so I do think there's a value in today's world to having that timeless state where kids are free to play, to explore without the crushing element of time. You know, I've seen kids today being rushed from one place to another place. Everything seems to be by appointment, and you know their days are scheduled out from the time they get up in the morning till late into the evening.
Right.
There is a value, obviously, to time. There's a value to organization. There's a value to learning a sense of order. But I think our society has become a little bit too time-pressed in that the clock tends to rule our behaviors.
Well, I think part of that's just because with the fact that our neighbor could be someone who's halfway around the world, it kind of makes us all try to compete with one another, and everyone wants to compete and have the greatest step up. And I think it's both because parents love their children that they do this, but it's not necessarily good for them because it's like it forces them to, you're right, because it forces them to lose that kind of timelessness of summer. And I remember when growing up, you get into a summer vacation, and I think it was 6, 7, 8 weeks or something. And it's like, that is just forever. And like, you're halfway through your second week and you're like, I want to do something. And you don't necessarily have to, you're like, I'll do it tomorrow or I'll do it next week. Like I have all that time, and then you kind of, you play games or you go out, and it's just, it is a seemingly endless time. It's a, like, I don't obviously have that time anymore. But I think I really do appreciate the time that I had to do that and play with friends and really kind of go out and about and, I don't know, have fun and kind of figure out what I wanted to, like, do during that period of time. And I think it's just super competitive now. Like, yeah, sure. I did things like soccer and played other sports when I was a lot younger. But there was something about the fact that I had a lot of free time that I did enjoy.
Well, I think that we've entered a period of innocence lost, which is why I think imagination was important. Going back to my early years, my early school years, growing up in a suburban community on the New Jersey side of the Delaware River from Philadelphia. On a summer day, you know, after the weeds were pulled or whatever we were supposed to do during that day or whatever else we had to do around the house, it was really timeless. I could be one block over in a friend's backyard, or they could be over in our backyard, or I'd just hanging out with the neighbors. We could make up our own games.
Right.
Okay. There was a time of innocence. We'd walk together down to the 7-Eleven, probably stretching over a mile.
Right.
You know, there is no sense of the same type of risks that kids face today. Okay, and then moving on to kind of what was a rural community in New England. It was one of the last straggling suburbs of New York City. From the standpoint that people would commute to the city. We'd have a lot of plane pilots living there. They'd have to be in New York City every day, you know, based on their schedule. They'd make the commute as they needed to. Some would commute into the southern part of, towards New York State in southern Connecticut.
Right.
But the place where we were living was at that point about 2-acre zoning.
Right.
And so you had a lot more open space.
Right.
Okay. You had a little bit more freedom. Freedom with that space.
Right.
And I think the way that kids, well, adults, all of us, are kind of crowded into never-ending metropolis.
Right.
Has its challenges. Just sitting up looking at the stars at night, being out of, let's say, the smog layer, whatever the case may be, being able to really take in much of the...
Just the world, I guess.
Much of the evening sky.
Right.
Yeah, I remember as a kid being up in Maine. We would go up to Maine during the summer for a couple of weeks, and just lying on my back at a place called Lake Pemaquid and just watching the meteor shower. That was just fantastic. You know, the further we got away from the hustle and bustle of civilization, the clearer the sky would be, the more stars we could see, the more objects in the evening sky. And it gave us a healthy sense of humility.
Right.
You had all of that out there to see.
Right.
Whereas here, living in Los Angeles County, you know, I might see a few specks in the sky, the level of
yeah,
of
but
light
even
pollution.
If you do see the specks in the sky, you're always in the back of your mind going, it's probably a plane or a helicopter or something flying
around. Right, something blinking out there. You kind of watch for a moment to see if it's stationary, if it's moving.
Right.
There's a loss of, let's say, context.
Right.
Seeing what appears like eternity before your eyes in the night sky. There's also something that I think triggers the imagination.
Right.
I think some of that, you know, really has been lost. Much of it has been taken to just take in the night sky, then understand that there is light and there is dark.
Right.
Okay. We're bombarded with light. There isn't really a, you know, kind of a dark time.
Right. No, there isn't.
So I think losing that contrast is something that's a little bit sad as well.
Yeah, I mean, two things. First is the fact that, I mean, when growing up, part of my me growing up, I did live, we lived in an apartment. And even though I didn't really see it as that restrictive, I think it was just kind of what it was. I did play a lot of video games, and I did kind of offset my imagination in some way to that. But it was also that we went out and we did things. I remember you had a pass to the zoo, and my sister and I would love going there on a regular basis. And it was one of those things where we would get out of the space, and my dad would just kind of give us free rein to kind of run around. I remember having, like, we had to hit certain locations every time we went. Like, we wanted to go to see the giraffes and the elephants, the reptile exhibit, and then the nocturnal animal exhibit was, those I think were the ones I, like, super remember wanting to go to. But it's having that kind of, in that channel of being able to kind of step out, because it's kind of an oasis almost in the middle of Los Angeles, where you really do get out of the hustle and bustle of things.
Yeah, the zoo membership was quite a bargain.
Yeah.
You know, kind of go in, you kind of walk through it. It is especially a bargain on peak days, because you can kind of like walk around the crowd and kind of go into, you know, the membership entrance. It was a place, well, obviously keeping an eye on the kids, but letting them.
No, yeah, no, obviously none of us got hurt or hurt at all whatsoever, but more just kind of being able to explore our curiosity.
Yeah, explore the curiosity. There's what was it? Every time we went there, there was a wax animal machine somewhere down by the koala.
That was the greatest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I always just wanted one of those things.
Yeah, the it got a little old after a while. Every time I went there, they wanted, you know, one of these little, one of these molded plastic little animals.
They would make them right in front of you. It was the coolest thing ever. Just like those giant pennies. Like when you're younger, it's just the, I don't know why, but they're the greatest thing ever. Like I want them, and they're kind of whatever about it, but I do remember that.
But, you know, the zoo was good. It was the chimpanzee exhibit that, what do they call those? Even forget the names names of the animals. The thing is that you'd be at the zoo so much you started referring to them by their scientific names, because you'd be reading the signs so
all
often.
The time, yeah. I remember. Yeah, it was great. And then
something like an Iberian ibex or something like that.
Oh yeah, you know, I remember having seen that all the time. And there were those certain goats that they had a little mountain as their in the exhibit. And I remember wanting to always go on them just because I liked watching the goats jump up and down, and like they weren't doing anything. It was just the most interesting thing, because every so often there would be a rush of movement where like one of them was overtaking the other, and it was like, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing. But I remember spending way too much time trying to just watch that exhibit to see what would happen. But I was also allowed to have that time. And then the second thing, as according to the whole darkness thing, is that in my room now, in my apartment, I have I have a large window that faces actually away from the street. But every night when I'm going to sleep, there's light that comes in my room. It's not that it bothers me, but it's this thing where I don't ever have total darkness. Like I'm never kind of left to my own devices and allowed to have the moonlight kind of shine. There is some moonlight, but it's also this kind of light in my room. And it's this weird thing where I can turn out all the lights and it doesn't feel like everything's off. And I actually got in the habit of doing it whenever I come home really late. I have a couple roads. One of them is actually a road to the zoo in LA. It's a lot darker than the rest of the roads, and it's just really enjoyable because you're almost kind of not seeing the street lights anymore. You're leaving them behind, and you're traveling down a road that is just you, and it's quiet, but it's also there's this like a somber kind of like what's the word for it. I don't know, it's something very enjoyable, just kind of having that.
I don't know. Is that the road that they fill with the lights when it's a season of lights?
Yes, that's the same road.
So it's kind of ironic there that road that you look to for darkness.
Yeah, winter is a hard time for those drives.
And then, you know, around the holidays, it's just filled with light.
Right. Which I think is interesting as well, because those kinds of holidays as well came about because winter, it's the darkest time of the year, and it's a representation that the light's not necessarily out. But it's kind of faded into existence because it's like right now when you see these beautiful houses with their all lit up with their Christmas lights, and it's done beautifully, and then all those lights are competing with the street lights on the block, and it just doesn't have the same effect sometimes.
Well, I guess being diurnal animals, that there's always that pressure to put light everywhere,
right?
Okay.
Yeah. But back to the point of it, just allowing, like, those drives that I take also open up a lot of that kind of imagination avenue, because it allows me to stop, like, the busyness of the city. You know, it allows me to just turn off everything, the hustle bustle that's going on, and just let me go to something. I remember growing up, we also did, it was after, I think, we watched Contact. They referenced this site called SETI Homepage, which is basically, as a screensaver, you could set up, you basically offshoot some of your computer power for scientific research in the searching sections of space.
Right, we had fun with that.
That was great. But I also remember Starry Night, the program.
Mm-hmm. Starry Night
is both a song by Don McLean and
Starry Night,
a painting. But Starry Night, and going out there with our telescope, and we find it on the. I remember we needed to find it on the computer, and we'd find the coordinates, and then we'd find it in the sky afterwards. We'd like run out of the house, look through the telescope, and try to find it. But yeah, having that access to that whole like mesh of like right now, it's like I don't need to look at an astronomy textbook to be able to find some of these constellations. I can there's so many different apps that I can do that with, but it's also I still enjoy like looking through the lens of the telescope and actually seeing it for yourself. Like it's not any different. Like they're just like it's either lights on a computer or lights from the star that's hundreds maybe or hundreds of light years away. You know, it's even though one of them's obviously way cooler than the other, they're still just kind of lights, but it's going out there and being able to see and kind of use your imagination to
right,
think
we go back to the imagination again, and in that humbling and awe-inspiring moments of looking at something much bigger than ourselves,
right?
That kind of just hangs out there in the sky, and then watching the position of the stars change and new stars appear in the sky based on the season.
Right.
That's all something I think, you know, would be good for kids to be able to appreciate.
Right.
We've lost a little bit of our connection to the natural world.
Right.
Okay. That also creates some art, some issues of just, you know, disconnection from where we came from, so to speak, as a species.
Right. Well, I think it's even a disconnection from ourselves. Like it's the disconnection from like the world around us and a disconnection from the people around us. It's like we are moving away from, in a weird, strange kind of, not to me too sci-fi about this, but like moving away from like this kind of weird physical thing and moving into a cyber space. And mm-hmm. even though it's not like we have cyber implants, but it's just this general movement to want to be away from everything, you know? But yeah, that's there is a kind of, I don't know. I try to take a second to, appreciate, like, I only know a select few constellations now. Like, I know how to point them out, but every time I see, I come back really late at night, and I'll point out Orion because it's easy in the sky. But it's just a memory, you know. Like it's a cool kind of way of going, like, there's other planets, and then I think, you know, it's allowing you to kind of think of the possibilities, you know.
Right. You know, years ago, many, many years ago, well, a lot of years ago, I worked on the White House detail, and I would visit the state capitals. I think in a period of about 14 months or something, I did 34 trips myself. It's kind of weird. You wake up and you got to look at your itinerary because the inside of the Hyatt Regency looks the same no matter where. No matter where you're staying.
Yeah, it must be confusing. Like, where am I today? Where did I come into today?
Yeah, where am I? Where am I at the moment? It looks strangely familiar with the inside of the hotel room. You can, you know, that alone kind of a little bit of a displacement there. You're in some place new, some place you haven't been before, but the inside of the room is strangely familiar. So you wake up, okay, that's where I am today. That's right. That's where I am. But in any case, I was traveling the state capitals. I was on a White House detail, series of small business conferences, I think 55 state-level conferences, 5 or 6 regional conferences, and then a national conference. Right. And so I was the issues coordinator for the conferences and had to take sometimes the garbled wording, the efforts at shorthand or whatever it was and turn it into something discernible. That someone could read. And I was never questioned on the accuracy of, well, my interpretation, even so some of these things came right. in looking a little bit like hieroglyphics. But moving away from the big commercial centers, a lot of these state capitals were in, they were smaller cities. State capitals weren't necessarily the big commercial centers.
That's just like... California, where it's Sacramento, is technically the capital, but San Francisco is a short trip away, and Los Angeles. And
yeah, well, Sacramento itself is a surprisingly large city.
Right.
One contrast might be, for example, Albany.
Right.
Versus New York City.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I always forget that Albany is technically the capital of New York.
And you get onto some of these state capitals, and depending where you are in the country, just kind of getting, you know, continuing with getting back to our roots, right. so to speak. It was always interesting to be in areas with a heavy farming influence.
Right.
Okay. The concerns of the farmers would be much different than people in coastal metropolises.
Right.
So their outlook, their interests. Their concerns were much different. These weren't right. necessarily big, quote unquote, big city concerns,
right.
but the problems that they faced as small business people were as valid
right.
To their way
Lives,
of life
yeah.
right? and to the economy that provided them with a way to make a living.
Right.
But there was always something, you know, kind of just matter of fact, pretty simple, pretty focused. Not a lot of sophistication necessarily, but
right.
you know, straight on a topic.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So I think we remove ourselves from the land, so to speak. We pick up, you know, a lot of sophistication. It isn't
right.
easy living in Los Angeles.
Right.
You've got to be nimble. You've got to be educated. You really have to be aware. Is one approach to living.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, coming off the land is a different approach to living, not endorsing one way of life over the
right.
other. But I can see in the people and their outlook, those who were closest to the land.
Right.
And it was just kind of a, you know, an interesting contrast coming right. out of Washington, D.C. Here I am in my mid-20s, whatever the case may be, flying into town, visiting with very good people, you know, in,
right.
in the context of airing their small business concerns. But really, it was interesting to see the different way of life, the different outlook, the different concerns from place to place, region to region, and economy to economy,
right,
all
right.
within, you know, between the two oceans.
Right.
It's quite a bit of diversity in outlook and thinking and way of life,
right,
that I think is really marvelous. I think, but
I really love that kind of diversity. It just that like that whole like way of life thing reminds me of there was a coworker in my first job in a warehouse, and he's like, you'll notice who comes from a city and who doesn't just by the way they drive off of a stop sign, because someone from a city is very, very fast, very time oriented. Every time is money. So you go, go, go. So when you're going at a stop sign, someone who's from a city will like stop as quickly as possible. Yeah, it's California stop. So they don't they're rolling stop, even though it's illegal. People do it just to make sure they can get off the line as quickly as possible. And then as you move further away from the city, they slow down where it's like, you stop, you even like, there's like a beat of a second before you even start back up on the road. And I just think it's funny when those two really collide, because especially when the kind of slow way of life is in front, because you can see just kind of the people seething behind the wheel when they 1 second goes by and the truck in front of them hasn't moved.
Well, one of the things that is this patchwork of, we'll call it almost, a patchwork quilt, let's say, of opinions, of outlooks,
right,
of ways of life, is on display now in America.
Right.
The interests of people can be much different,
right,
across the country, city, town, country. And as we're just seeing it play out politically before our eyes,
right,
we are a nation that's greatly divided.
Right.
And as one writer said a few presidential cycles ago, it's no longer an issue of what, you know, candidate you believe. Of course, I'm paraphrasing it.
Right.
Now, it's now an issue of what reality do you subscribe.
Right.
So I think that one of the skills,
right,
that we've lost is really the ability to find consensus.
Right.
Whereas I think today people are more and more looking less to the news for information, but picking their news sources.
Right. Well, to find which person do you want to be mad at is essentially kind of what you're choosing. Is that when you're choosing your news sources, it's like, do I want to be mad at, I don't know, the person in charge, or do I want to be mad at all the people who are stopping the person in charge? And it's this funny thing where it's like, you're almost choosing just to say who your kind of side is going for at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of tragic.
Well, I think people are more driven towards confirmation bias.
Right.
Finding a source of information, I'll call it information.
Right.
I'll call it, source of content that confirms their beliefs.
Right. I think, yeah.
Which is kind of interesting considering the many different avenues of information we have available to us today.
Right. And I think, and even drawing it back even further to what we were talking about before, is that we have this medium of technology and like this medium of imagination. And what we're doing, especially now with technology and having all these new sources and having all this kind of loudness in our face about it, is that we're kind of coming up on the edge of this thing where people aren't using their imagination. They're kind of offsetting that thought process, this ability to even think about and imagine these other scenarios that could be different than theirs. And when you go to these, choosing the story or even choosing the narrative that you want to follow, it's not even people choosing like, this is the what I believe, so that's why I'm reading it. It's more of he agreed with me a couple times, so I'll agree with him on this matter. And I think that's almost kind of sad. But it's a difference. It's like we're very much learning how to cope with the fact that we have all this information, where before we had this kind of old way of thinking where it was, you'd have a newspaper, and some people would have a daily newspaper if you lived in kind of more major cities, but there wasn't a 24-hour news cycle. If you really are an avid kind of news reader, you would get it in the morning on the day after. And then Sunday was a big, everyone got the Sunday newspaper and they would read that and read through it. But it's also in that it's a little bit slower because you're not getting it by the time. And if you really, there was radio obviously for the news, but it wasn't what kind of overwhelmed our life. And that's what kind of happened is that, like, instead of reading and writing and doing all this other stuff, we're kind of pushed.
It was interesting. About 12 years old, I had a paper route.
Yeah.
And so, it was a weekday newspaper called the Courier Post. And I had a friend lived a street over who had a newspaper route for the Sunday, for competing newspaper, mm-hmm. That had a Sunday edition. And it was just one of those kind of, well, odd things. I mean, to realize that the Sunday newspaper was actually put to bed, much of it was put to bed, long before the press time. Because when I would cover his paper route, we would have some of the classified ads, things like that, delivered before the newspaper, and we had to actually assemble the newspaper to deliver it.
Right.
Okay, so we didn't have the 24/7 news cycle. We did have the evening news, which, of course, if you want the timely news, I remember really adults talking about their favorite newscaster.
Right.
Okay. It wasn't
so
much their point of view. It might have been just the way that they presented the news, whether you're into Walter Cronkite or, one of the other stations, one of the other networks for news. The newscast, they look forward to that news half hour.
Right.
You gather around the television set. To watch the evening news. Mm-hmm. Vastly different than what it is today, where you're on a constant news cycle, or even different from my own parents who came of age before the mass adoption of television.
Right.
And so talking about imagination, you'd have to sit around the radio. You would sit around the radio and you'd have to make your own mental images.
Right.
They would be highly descriptive. Highly descriptive programming, but still there was nothing to look at. And I think again, we've lost something where the senses are constantly saturated.
Right.
Okay, we've lost something about developing imagination, and I think imagination is really important. I think imagination brings about a great deal of creativity and helps people to see beyond limits. So if they can imagine it, it can happen.
Right. Okay. I can imagine, especially for something like, I don't know, space is definitely something we talked about, but just the imagination of someone like even Kennedy when he's opening I don't know if this is an inaugural speech, but one of the speeches when he's talking about going to the moon, and it was more of, we don't know how we're going to get there. And in his speech, he says, we're not going because there's any reason to go. We are going because it's there and we should go. Like that is the only reason he gave in that speech. He had quoted the first man to climb Mount Everest. Saying people were asking why he went to climb Mount Everest, and he just said because it was there. It's that kind of being able to look up in the stars or even look out and see something more.
I think in the Kennedy statement was in the context of the Cold War.
Right. Of course.
Trying to look, turn that anxiety, at least some of that anxiety, turn the imagination turn the focus away from building arms to exploration.
Right, and I think, well, it's even just using our imagination for something a little bit brighter and a little bit more kind of, I guess, in a sense, more beautiful than kind of trying to blow each other up. And that's what I'm trying to get at is that, like, being able to use this imagination, this power that I think out of all the creatures on Earth, we have been the only creature who has obviously been, who's ever been known to have that kind of imagination power. There's no other creature that is able to plan ahead or even imagine scenarios that have never happened. So it's our greatest strength, and I would hate to see us lose it. Cool. All right. So that's the end of this podcast. Thank you for listening. If you end up liking this, I'll continue to do this. I really enjoyed it talking with my dad for an hour, so I am kind of partial to having him talk about other things. So I hope you enjoy, and thank you for listening.